It's time to break the silence and open up the dialogue around the topics of miscarriage and baby loss.
No more shame, no more taboo. Let's ditch it for the sake of our children.
The ones who are, the ones who will come.
And in memory of the ones who never came to be.
This is the Worst Girl Gang Ever podcast. Hello and welcome to this episode of the Worst Girl Gang Ever. Today we have got Danny Benedict here with us, who has come to share her story with us all. Welcome, Danny.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you so much for joining us. So we say this a lot, but would you like to start at the beginning and tell us about your experience?
That's the best place to start, isn't it?
Yes.
It is.
Okay. So I'm almost 5 years into my grief journey. February 26, 2019, I gave birth to my daughter, Olivia Grace. A very boring, normal and routine pregnancy. And I went into spontaneous labour at 36 weeks and unfortunately had a concealed placental abruption during labour, which was catastrophic. She was starved of oxygen, which led to severe brain damage. But she's a little fighter, and she lived for 5 weeks, 2 days, before we, you know, we had to make a really nasty decision to go to a hospice and say goodbye.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Yeah, it's just awful. And so that was February 26, 2019.
Yeah.
Wow. And what? So you say your pregnancy was all completely normal. There was nothing.
No.
No symptoms. And what about the labour itself?
I mean, she was my first baby. So I had no, I mean, you can take all the classes, can't you, and read everything about birth, but until you go through it, you don't know. But my labour, looking back and in hindsight, it was certainly not a normal labour. It was very quick. I progressed extremely quickly. Went from 3 centimetres to 10 and pushing in maybe 45 minutes. Excruciating pain, back-to-back contractions that just would come up to my throat. They felt suffocating. And I remember thinking, is this what it's supposed to be like? You know, it certainly didn't seem, it wasn't what I expected. I don't know what I expected, but it wasn't, you know. And I do remember saying in the labour, this is too fast. This is too fast. She showed signs of distress in labour and was decelling. So they had called the button, which thank God they did, because, you know, when she did come out, she came out in extremely poor. I mean, she came out basically dead, but they managed to successfully resuscitate. You know, so all the neonate doctors were there ready, because I was very slightly premature as well at 36 weeks. You know, thank God they were, and they worked amazingly, and they did everything that they should do. You know, they followed, there's a specific, you know, hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy, that's what she had, HIE. They followed all the protocol, they got her on the cooling mat to try and control the seizures, and, you know, everything was just so quick. It's a bit blurry now. Mm-hmm. I'm in that protective state of, yeah, I can't remember it too much, otherwise it just puts me into a state of frenzy and panic, you know.
Yeah. And in the so she lived for 5 weeks, did you say?
5 weeks, 2 days old, yeah.
And Olivia was her name.
Olivia Grace
is her name.
She's so special, she got two first names.
Olivia Grace, that's a beautiful name. And what happened following Olivia Grace's birth?
So she was very quickly rushed off to the Norfolk and Norwich NICU. We were pre-warned that she was so severe that she might not even make the transfer, you know. So I'd given birth. It was a case of do whatever they need to do to me. I got up, I got dressed, I was straight round to see her. Then it was back in the car, drive home, pack a bag. Nothing about that experience was a normal delivery, you know. I was walking within a very quick time after giving birth because it was just go, 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 you know.
That's what you had to do, right?
Yeah.
And at the time,
with her.
Like retrospectively, are you amazed that your body just coped?
I don't know. Yeah, the adrenaline must have just, because I had no pain relief in labor. I had nothing, not even paracetamol, because it was so quick. I had time for nothing, no gas and air. I just did it. And then, yeah, you're bleeding and torn, and I just was up and out the door, and you know, get in the car, get over to the NICU. I don't know how my body. It caught up with me, I remember, because I think it was about 36 hours after, and it was 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was sitting with her on, you know, still in just a complete state of shock. And I remember falling to the floor. I think I passed out. I couldn't stand anymore. I think it all just hit me and my body just, you know, and I just fell to the floor. And the next thing I remember is I sort of woke up from a very deep sleep, however many hours later. It was just a lot. It was a lot, yeah.
And then at that point, presumably your body just couldn't do anymore.
No, I think, yeah, our bodies can only cope with so much trauma before you have to protect yourself as well, don't you, you know?
Yeah.
So, what were you doing in the NICU for Olivia Grace? What was happening when she got moved there?
So she was on a cooling regime, and they call for however long, and then they gradually warm them up again, and that's to prevent any secondary damage, brain damage from the lack of oxygen. That was terrifying because we were warned of seizures, and I didn't know how she was going to respond to being warmed up. It was, you know, hour by hour monitoring, and they do it very slowly and gradually, and it was just one of the scariest things I think I'll ever have to go through. I was terrified to sit next to her. I was terrified looking at the monitors, you know. But she was warmed up, and I think she got through it without any seizures. But you know, every day they'd come round and do their rounds in the morning, and they do their tests and see how responsive, I suppose, she is. At that point, she was still intubated on every form of life support, and you know. And it definitely wasn't looking good in those first few days. The consultants were honest, you know, which I appreciate their honesty, but that was really hard. And then so the first thing that they wanted to see was, could she, you know, was the brain damage so severe? Did it affect her most, you know, primal reflexes? Could she actually breathe on her own without a ventilator? And again, we were warned that because of how bad the brain damage was, that was quite unlikely that she would be able to breathe on her own. But she did. Sorry. I remember, you know, I work medical too, so I understand a lot of this. So I remember seeing I was watching the ventilator. And I knew which part was the ventilator and which part was her. And, she, you know, there was one breath that was her. And I was like, oh, my gosh, that's her. That's her. She did it. She took a breath. And then it'd be the vent, the vent, the vent. And then she'd do another breath. And then she started to do more and more and more. And I was like her cheerleader. I was like, come on, you can do this, you know. And she did. She breathed on her own, you know. So that was kind of, that was step one. That was like, can she do that? Because if she can't do that, a decision would have been made a lot sooner. But she did. I was very, very proud of her.
I bet. It must be so hard just standing by and watching all of this happen. You must feel pretty powerless in this situation, but not knowing whether she's going to survive, and then also if she does, what will her life be like?
Yeah, and that's the thing with, you know, brain damage. A lot of it was that they could never give us true answers. You know, they could do all the scans and MRIs and all these tests, but because a neonate's brain has so much neuroplasticity, and they can learn how to do things, and they'll just do it in a different way. Their brain will just, it's incredible. It's so clever. Yeah, it just figures it out. So they could never say, you know, they didn't think that she'd live through the transfer. Then they didn't think she'd survive the first night. And then it was, okay, we don't think she's going to be able to breathe. And she breathed. And slowly, as they were weaning the morphine, she started to move her limbs. And there was a bit of a response there. So it was so up and down, because we kept getting these moments of hope. And, you know, I just remember saying, I don't care. I will learn how to take care of her. I can do it. You know, we're going to love her no matter what anyway, you know, but we will just learn how to take care of her. And so they kept progressing with those steps, and, you know, they weaned the ventilator off, and they were like, okay, she is breathing. Let's extubate. And they did. She needed reintubating. Unfortunately, she crashed. She was about a week old, and within sort of 24 hours of being extubated, she did crash, which was, you know, nobody should see CPR being done to their baby. It was terrible. But then they tried again, and she did really well, and she had additional breathing support, but just not as invasive as a, you know, a tube down her throat. But unfortunately, where I thought we were heading in the direction of stepping down, you know, she was doing really well. The turning point was she developed this really bad stridor and laryngomalacia type noise. Basically, they said, you know, the brain damage could be, you know, it's affecting her reflexes and, you know, and her vocal cords. And, you know, it was hopefully as she grows up, you know, older, she'll develop some tone and hopefully it will get better and, you know, whatnot. But when they looked further into it, she had bilateral vocal cord palsy. So her vocal cords, because of the brain damage, were paralyzed shut. And that means no airway. So without a trachee, there was no way. So she fought for 12 days on BiPAP with bilateral vocal cord palsy, which was just I'm just in awe of what she did, you know. But it was, yeah, too much in the end. So,
and when did they make that decision, or how did you know, what happened to make that final decision of going into a hospice?
So everything was done, you know, very slowly. Nothing rushed with her, you know. She was extubated the first time at a week old, and then it was okay, that didn't work, so let's just give her another few more days and try again. And then it was, you know, however many days being on the BiPAP machine, and then that was again a step down to, okay, she's doing all right, her bloods look good, let's put her on just some nasal cannula, you know, just very small amount of oxygen support. And so each step was very slow over that sort of 5-week period. And it was the Wednesday. We went to the hospice on Thursday, the 4th of April. And it was the Wednesday prior that the ENT specialist came, and he was the one to diagnose the vocal cord palsy. And that's when, because of my background, I understood what that meant. That was we're out of options type deal, you know, unless I insist on her going to Great Ormond Street to have a tracheotomy put in, there is no other way. So you know, we accepted that that was that, and they got in touch with the NICU team, got in touch with a local hospice, and then it was however many days of preparing, planning, making sure that we could do it in the, you know, I mean, there's no word, nicest way possible. I mean, nice isn't the word, is it? The right way for us, what we needed, the memories we needed to make, et cetera, et cetera.
And did you have family around to support you through all this?
Yes, yes, yeah. It was, you know, me and her daddy and grandmas, we were all together. And on the final day, we chose that it would just be me and daddy and her, you know, in the bed for the first time as a family of three, while they took the a compassionate extubation, they call it. They removed the breathing tube and we just had to wait. Yeah.
So sorry, Danny.
Pretty shit. Yeah.
So what happened at the hospice? How did they look after you there? Because I think a lot of people don't get the hospice experience, do they? They would lose their baby. Mm-hmm. At the NICU or on the ward?
Yeah, so I had specifically said that I did not want her to pass away in the hospital. I remember hearing so many mums scream, cry when they lost their baby. And it just, like, it's a noise that just haunts me now. And I was like, I can't, there's other little babies here fighting for their life, there's other mums here, you know, I can't do this here, I need to be somewhere private with her. So the hospice was, it wasn't far, it was maybe only 20-30 minutes down the road. You know, so even that was, it was a risk transferring her even for that. But the ladies from the hospice had come and they, you know, talked us through. I went to see the hospice before we went there. I told them, you know, there was a cot in the room and I broke down when I walked in. I said, why is there a cot in here? That's not her bed. It's not her bed. You know, take it away. I didn't want it, you know. So they made sure that it was as much, you know, for us and our needs as it could be. You know, we had her baptized in their lounge. Their local priest came and just did something small with us, and that meant a lot. And they were very, very helpful. You know, they did things that I wouldn't even think, like, I mean, how do you know what to do? How do you plan your baby's death before it's happened? I mean, it's just, you can't, can you? So they made sure to take fingerprints, which they had casted in silver, which I've got on my necklace. They're her fingerprints. They just did that because, you know, any kind of memory that we could possibly get from them, they, you know, made sure. And, you know, they arranged the room, you know, what flowers did I want in the room? You know, what did I not want in the room? The cot, you know. So they really did try to consider everything that a parent would need, you know, because you just need that support.
Yeah, yeah. And how long did you have with Olivia Grace at the hospice?
I want to say close to about 4 hours. To 4 hours she held on. Which was, I mean, I didn't want her to. She didn't suffer. They were very good, but it was like I already knew what was going to happen, and I was so burned out from life on the NICU and seeing the things that I'd seen and having to make the decisions and, you know, signing a DNAR on your 28-day-old baby is just not something anyone should have to do, you know. And I think I just, you're so torn. I wanted her to hold on and be this miracle. I wanted her to hold on, and I wanted them to say, call the ambulance back. She's still breathing, you know, get her back to the hospital. And then the other half of me, I just wanted her to just go. So, you know, I could just hold her. But I knew that phase was coming. I knew that next phase was coming. I knew I would have to except that she had passed away. So the longer she held on, it was just, it's so conflicting, confusing, you know.
Yeah, I think we always hold on to that little bit of hope, don't we? Even
yeah.
being told that this is the end, that there's still something there. Your mind still, I mean, hope is lovely, but it also is a mind fuck.
Yeah. And especially because she had already defied so many things that they said, well, she won't do this and she won't do that. And I mean, she opened her eyes. She hadn't opened her eyes. And I kept thinking, if she doesn't open her eyes, I think that's her. She's not going to stay. You know, how can you live but never wake up or open your eyes? And I knew that she'd likely be blind because of the brain damage, but she did open her eyes. The little sod waited for me to leave. She did it for my mum. She did it for grandma. And I got a phone call with my mum. She's opened her eyes. I thought, of course she has. I'm not, you know, I spent 15 hours a day next to her cot, and she chose to wait for, you know, when my mum had given me a break. But I felt like that she wants to live. That's her. She's telling us she wants to live. She's really trying. She's really trying. And, you know, there was a part of me that thought, when we go to the hospice, maybe she will be a miracle. Maybe she will be one of those stories that you read about, and, you know, but they can't fix broken brains yet.
No.
I'm so sorry.
So, the warrior ship, we wanted to come and tell you a little bit about it, didn't we, Bex?
And in case you're already going, why? We don't want to know about a fucking ship. The warrior ship is our online membership for warriors in this community.
It's packed full of stuff. So we just want to tell you about some of the stuff. All of the content from all of the courses that we ever run is in the warriorship. So there's loads to get your teeth into.
And we are also developing modules for what happens after.
But not only that, we've also got a ton of educational workshops running once a month. In the coming months, we have got body positivity workshop, gratitude workshop, and loads more.
And on top of that, we also have a resident mental health specialist. And on top of that, as if that wasn't enough, there's 13 events every month. And there's stuff popping up all the time as well that other people are organising that you can be a part of. So it really is thriving.
And all you have to do is head to the link in our bio or visit our website, and you can be a part of this too.
We'd love to see you there.
Gosh, that sounds just like torture, really, having to go through all of that.
I think it's even now, so, you know, this February I'll be coming up to, she would have been 5 years old. I think even still now, a lot of the time, it feels surreal.
Yeah.
And I question, I'm like, am I still alive after going through that? Or was that really not real? Or, because I think, you know, if our brain was to truly know that pain, I mean, how would we live through it? I think it puts you in a protective bubble, because, you know, that's, I can't think of, you know, that's, it's like the most traumatic thing I can imagine someone going through. You know,
and I bet you don't think you're going to live through it, do you? And you don't think you're ever going to enjoy life again or ever going to feel better again.
No, and that's kind of where, you know, a lot of the, you know, in my grief process, you know, I was writing anyway, but that was a lot of behind why I wrote and released the book that I did, because not only did I want that story printed for me to have on my bookshelf, so that I didn't want to forget any of the details, and it was this reminder that I lived that first year, you know. And I know that when other new lost mums start this journey, and it's just so much, and it's so painful, and it's so overwhelming, and it's so scary, the thought of living feeling this way. And, you know, and I thought, well, if someone was to read this book and just know, you will survive, you know. I don't know how you're going to survive, but you will. So hopefully it offers a little bit of connection and
hope. Yeah, tell us a bit more about the book. When did you start writing it, and why, and how's it going, and all that stuff?
So I started it, I think I might have been home 2-3 weeks from the NICU, and I was drunk, and I needed to let a lot of pain out of my heart. So
yeah.
I opened the laptop and I wrote the very first thing, which was the title of the book, and it has remained the same, you know, the whole time, and that is A Lost Mum's Journal. But very unoriginal, you know, that's what it was, A Lost Mum's Journal.
Yeah.
And I just wrote, and then I'd put the laptop away for a few days, and I'd go back and just jot down a few more little things. And every time I did it, I felt, because of the way I write to her, it's all to her. That helped me feel close to her, you know,
yeah,
and maybe make sense of some of the things that I was feeling. So I said to myself, I will write until her first birthday, and then, you know, if I want to carry on, that's great. But if I don't, and if I need a bit of a rest from it, that's kind of where I'll, and that's where I have closed the, you know, that's the final chapter in the book is her first birthday. So yeah, it was a year's worth of writing, I suppose, but then I did nothing with it. I was, you know, life, COVID.
Yeah.
And then January this year, I was like, right, I need to, you know, every year I've said, I'm going to do this. Every year I tried to do something for her. But I, you know, I did it this year. It's January. I reached out to a little publishing company and they helped me. And it was a lot of back and forth. That part was very stressful. Self-publishing is hard. There's a lot more that goes into writing and making a book than I ever realized. But the official release date was the 1st of September. And I'm very, really, really proud of it. It's mine. Yeah, it sits very, very proudly on my bookshelf.
Yeah, it's lovely. It's a lovely memory for Olivia Grace as well. Just the fact that you've been able to help other people that have gone through a similar experience or will go through a similar experience. It's nice that her life has and will contribute to the comfort of others.
Yeah, I hope so. I know there's some, you know, when you lose a baby and like there are things that you're afraid to say out loud, or you question, am I crazy? Is this is normal? I hate that word these days, but you know, do other people feel this? And so all of that, I wrote it down. It's very raw. It's, you know, there's no filter to it. It's not sugarcoated. It's real. This is the reality of living life with baby loss. And I really hope that it does help other people. I hope it helps the non-loss community too, to understand and change some of their, you know, bullshit expectations on what they think it should be like. And that the minute the funeral ends, everything's back to normal. But what people don't realize as well is every time someone reads this book and they know her name and see her face and know her story, that helps my heart too.
Mm.
You know, they are instrumental in my healing.
Yeah.
So yeah, the book has definitely, it has achieved way more than I ever thought it would, you know.
That's amazing.
Thank you. So
tell us about how life has been generally for the last 5 years.
Oh my gosh. Well, my memory is destroyed from grief, so it's very up and down. As you know, the occasions are hard. You know, her dates are very, very hard. I feel a massive shift, so soul deep, and no one else can see, but I feel it. You know, this anxiety that comes with the countdown to her birthday. So for me, it will be the 1st of January. Something shifts, and because I know her birthday is coming, you know, I still work, I still socialize, I still have family life. I'm living, but she is very much still living with me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not moving on. I'm just moving forward, and I'm choosing to bring her with me, you know? So a lot of what I do now, it's all for her. She is still very much present to me. I make baby loss awareness pieces, you know, I'd like to do more with my writing. I write poetry. I do other lost mums poems for their babies. And that just, it brings me comfort, you know, to do that. But it's still not without its challenges.
Yeah, of course. In so many ways, like 5 years is, 5 years when you say it, it feels like a long time, but actually it goes past so quickly, doesn't it, in the scheme of things? Yeah. And obviously last September, I'm guessing, would have been Olivia Grace's start at school.
Yes, it was.
Was that a massive challenge for you?
Yes, last year I was semi-okay on her birthday, but on her death day, it was the worst. I think it was actually worse than her first, and I couldn't figure out why. And then I think it hit me that she wouldn't have been a baby anymore. You know, I had this bouncing, full-grown toddler, you know, this four-year-old coming up to go into school. And I think it was this huge, what the hell would my life have looked like if that didn't happen, you know? And then it's that fear that it's like, wow, yeah, I'm 4 years into this. But 4 years isn't that long in a lifetime of missing someone. And the idea of feeling this pain for the rest of my life scares me. I don't want to get through the next, I don't know, 30, 40 maybe years hurting like this, you know. So that this past one was not a good year for me, and I take each one just as they come, because people say to me, how, you know, have you thought about what you'd like to do, is there something special you'd like to do? And I'm like, I don't know. I will listen to my heart on the day, and I will do what feels right for me in that moment, because I can't predict what grief is going to look like to me in 2 months. You know, so my friends and family are very good. They just kind of, they follow my lead. They come along for the ride. They let me tell them what I need, which I think is the most important thing when someone's grieving, isn't it?
Yeah, that's really helpful.
And how is your partner kind of dealing or dealt with it?
Me and Olivia Grace's father are not together anymore.
I'm sorry.
It's grief. We separated very soon after she passed away.
Right.
So, but I don't talk too much about him, but I, you know, I will always say I'm so grateful and will always be grateful to him for co-creating the most precious, beautiful baby on this planet. And you know, he loves her with his whole heart, and I wish him all the best.
Yeah, wow, that's, it's just grief is just such a inexplicable and personal journey, isn't it? It's you never know what it's going to throw at you, and how the depth and the intensity of some of those emotions that you've just been describing when you said, you know, about your soul, I could feel that in what you were saying. You know, I could feel the unbelievable depth of your pain is just so, I'm so sorry that you're going through all that. Have you had any sort of therapy and grief counseling and stuff like that? Or
I, you know, when I came home from the NICU, I knew that this next phase in my life was going to be so hard, and you know, I was going to take any and all help and support I was going to get. You know, so I went straight with Petals, which the bereavement team arranged. And then on and off throughout the years, when I've needed that help, when I felt myself struggling a bit more, maybe, than, you know, and I just pick up some counselling again and just have that person to talk through things, you know. Because it's that there isn't a word to describe, you know, it's, I think grief for a lost parent, I mean, they already know that it's so different to normal grief. They've proved that now, that baby loss is on its own, standalone, you know, it's an enduring grief that will likely last a lifetime. And, you know, that love between a mother and their baby, it's unconditional, it's unique, it's a bond that is not broken by death. So yeah, I went straight for all the anything and everything I could do, support groups, therapy, took it all.
And did you find it, I mean, do you find it helpful in those times of real darkness?
Yeah, yes, I think so. I mean, no one can take, you know.
Yeah, sure.
I can't take away someone else's pain, and you know, but it does help to have that safe space to talk. I think everybody needs help anyway. You know, we all need to support each other, you know, so especially with something like this. So
sometimes you get so wrapped up in your head, don't you? And you start, things seem bigger, or you feel sort of paranoia, or just, I don't know, your head does funny things to you. And when you actually verbalize what you're feeling, mm-hmm. it does make sense. And the same with writing as well. Writing, like you said, does help to make sense of things. Yeah. So, you know, we would always encourage people to talk and write and share, because it doesn't take the pain away, but it does lift the weight a little, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's finding an outlet that works, you know, for you. You know, yeah. I can get lost in writing and making these things for other people, and that is, for me, that's a good outlet, you know.
Yeah, so like the creativity, we do a bit of that on our membership platform, and it is a real lovely form of therapy.
Yeah.
What sort of things is it that you make, Danny?
So this is all quite, I started all of this stuff really in September. I just think I felt so inspired that I just went for it. I started the Facebook page, the book was released, and I opened up a little Etsy shop. So I do a lot of work with resin. I do resin art. I went to college for art and design and thought for many years that was a total waste of time, because I now work in the medical field. But as it turns out, no. And I do a lot that's, you know, bespoke, and it is all baby loss remembrance pieces. I really love to write poetry. Like I said, I offered to write a handful of mums' poems about their babies, just to do something nice for them. And the feedback that I got from that was lovely. You know, they said how beautiful they were. And I just feel so honoured when somebody will let me write about their baby, and they tell me about their baby, and I know how much that means to them. So I feel incredibly privileged to be able to do that. So those are the sort of things that I offer people.
Oh, lovely. And it's all in Olivia Grace's memory.
Yeah. Everything I do, everything I make, she's there.
Yeah, it's really special.
Really special. Thank you so much for sharing Olivia Grace's story with us, and everything you've done as well. And how can people find you on, what's your Etsy shop called?
Love and Loss OG.
Okay.
I'm a very new little shop. Just start. And plus I work 12-hour shifts, so time is tricky, but a lot as well. You know, my Facebook page is The Lost Mum, which anyone can find me on there. And it's just, I like to think it's a very safe, honest place, you know, just for some love, remembrance and connection.
Mm. Well, we'll put the links in the show notes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Danny. It's been really lovely chatting to you. And
thank you for having me.
Every story.
Thank you.
All right. Bye. All the best. Take care of yourself.
You too.
Bye.
Will do.
See you. Bye.